Good. Well, it's great to see so many people. I was worried that at this time of the year there would be just a handful of people down at the front here and the rest would be a resounding emptiness. I'm Robert Wade. I'm a professor of political economy in the Development Studies Institute at LSE. I'm chairing the event, and I want to now introduce Dr. Ian Golden, who is coming back to familiar territory. Familiar because he was a student here in 1979 doing an MSc in economics with sociology courses thrown in. Went on to do a DPhil at Oxford, went on through a number of steps to run the Development Bank of South Africa.
Southern Africa.
And then in 2001 was recruited by Nick Stern, formerly economist at LSE, to join the World Bank, where Nick was vice president for economic research. And then in 2003, Ian became vice president for external affairs of the World Bank. The external affairs budget of the World Bank is greater, I believe, than the research budget of the World Bank, whatever you want to make of that fact. He's going to talk today about this recently published book, Globalization for Development. And I have to say, just by way of introducing the book, that it is an excellent introduction to one perspective on globalization. Excellent in particular because it doesn't require any background of knowledge about the subject. It's very careful in the way that it sets out concepts and arguments. It's got lots of boxes and charts and very, very helpful for people who are coming into this subject for the first time. It takes what you could call a prioritarian approach to issues of globalization, which is to say prioritarian in the sense of priority. It proposes that we judge arrangements, rules, regimes for trade, for aid, for finance, for migration. We judge these according to their impact on the poorest people in the world, on the poorest 2 billion or so who live in conditions that anyone would agree are conditions of severe poverty. So that's the kind of standpoint. We look at the various arrangements in the world system for aid and finance and trade, and we ask what impacts these arrangements are having on poverty and how can the arrangements be changed so as to mitigate those impacts on poverty. So that's the introduction, and over to you.
Thank you very much, Robert, and thank you to so many of you for spending your Thursday evening. Yeah, I know there are lots of exciting things to do in London, and I'm not sure this is the most exciting of them. But thanks also to those that have gone into the video room. I can't see you, but you can see me. And at least you got in, and I really feel very bad, and particularly if they're friends of yours, do tell them for what seemed like many people that couldn't get into either rooms, and that's a pity. I came to LSE about a year ago. We were in the bigger lecture theatre then. And at that time, tried to focus on what the G8 at that time were doing to help overcome poverty and the sorts of things they were talking about at the Gleneagles Summit and at other summits. And that was, in fact, I came from a rally on Trafalgar Square on that occasion, which was part of Make Poverty History campaign. What I want to talk about today is a more broad perspective on this. And it really does draw very heavily on the book that was published about a month ago by Palgrave Macmillan and the bank, and there will be copies of it available, and I'm happy to talk to you about it afterwards as well. And the basic point...
Can I interrupt? There will be copies, or there are copies for sale outside for a mere £17, and they can even be signed if you wish to ask Ian to sign them.
Thank you, Robert, for doing the hard sell, which I'm too embarrassed to do myself. but the basic point of the book and the argument is that globalization, and we can go into discussions of how we define it, is an extremely important force. It's a force which is on the move, and that it cannot be determined before one examines it what its impact on poverty will be. There is no inevitability about the impact of globalization on poverty. In general, it can be a catalyst for poverty reduction, but there are cases in which where it has exacerbated poverty, there are cases where it has made things worse. And the key, and that's really what this is about, is to think about those policies that people can take in different spheres of influence to make sure that globalization is a force for good. That's the basic argument. And the spheres of influence are very varied. They're from the global level, national and global leaders when they get together, to the very local level, what people can do in their own communities, what they can do in their own villages, to try and shape the way that globalization impacts upon them. So that was the thinking behind the book. It's absolutely not about everything about globalization, and I imagine that's an impossible task in itself. It's about the key economic flows, trade, finance, aid, migration, ideas, and then the policy dimensions of these. And even within these, of course, it's only snapshots of those topics. You know, they're whole university departments that work on each of these things. They're vast topics, and what I tried to do with my co-author, Ken Reinhardt, was to pull out of them those salient features which impact on the poor through the flows across national boundaries. What the book is not about is the many other things that are perhaps even more important in globalization. And for me, the most important one, of course, is global peace and security. And whatever one thinks about any economic impact on the poor, it's nothing compared to the impact of, say, a nuclear bomb or conflict in general. And conflict is development in reverse. Conflict is the taking away of everything that people have constructed in their own lives over time. And so it really is very difficult to think about globalization without thinking about the need for global peace, for global stability, and the need to overcome the current conflicts in the world. That is not what the book's about, but I do want to put it up as a big caveat because I personally am passionate about this issue, and I think it's important that we join the dots between these different issues. It is also not about the global environment, climate change, and other global forces. They cross borders, but which are not economic flows. They're flows of carbon gases, they're flows of pollutants, they're flows of hazardous waste, and so on. But they are not necessarily economic flows. Of course, how one deals with them and why they're there is related to economics, and we can clearly come back to that. The book also is not about culture and how globalization interacts with culture. My personal view on this is that a lot has been said, but there's much more heat than light on this subject in the current debate on culture. And what I'm always struck about in the globalization discussions that I engage in, and I engage in them very widely around the world, is how people are able to retain their own identities, their cultural identities, their national identities, their traditions, and so on. And so you find in the most globalized cities like London, like New York, no dilution, in fact sometimes a stronger reflection of cultural identities than you find even in the homelands where they came from. So people's ability to mix cultures, to assert their own identities, absorbing others, is obviously an extremely important topic. But it does relate to certain economic flows, and particularly the trade flows, the intellectual property flows, and so on, are very associated with this brand, multinational companies, and so on. The book also deals with, but only, I would say on the side, with the global governance question. Who runs the world? How is it run? Is it run fairly? Should there be different global governance structures? What is the role of the global institutions in this? This is clearly something which I'm part of. The part of the World Bank that I have responsibility for includes all our relations with all the donor countries, including the UK and many 25 countries around the world. So I'm involved in these debates, and they're extremely live. They're live also in relation to the governance of the World Bank Group, of course, which remains dominated by institutions that created it 60 years ago. But that is not what the book is about. I do point in the book repeatedly to the need to have changes in global governance, though. Clearly, it really is a problem where we have a world in which many solutions require global coming together, global agreement, and we have institutions at the global level that are not able, for whatever reason, to grapple with these global solutions, be they on the environment, peace and war, or economic flows. We have a very, very heavy but very slow global governance system which reflects politics and powers which don't necessarily reflect where the world is or should be today. And that's obviously a major issue, subject in itself. It's about the reform of the United Nations system, reform of the Bretton Woods system. It's about the creation of, I think, a more effective global governance system. But that is not the key topic. So having said what the book's not about, let me talk about what it is. But those are the caveats. And again, I'm happy to give my own views on them in the conversation. I should also stress that I am working at the moment on something else, which just grew organically out of this, which is really drilling down on the migration and people part of this. And so that if I come back in a year, that's what I hope I'll be talking to you about if I'm invited back. Let me begin with a very simple illustration there's no one-way street here, either on globalization or poverty reduction. It is not the case that globalization is this inevitable force that just gets more and more and more powerful. It's also not the case that poverty just inevitably gets reduced or increases over time. Both of these things have their trends. They are not intercorrelated in any systematic way. The globalization debate itself tends to see this as something of a sort of a recent phenomenon. I really believe that globalization has been around as long as we have on the planet. And certainly people, you know, if you migrated out of Africa and got around the world over the last 100,000 years, we are all Africans. And in that sense, if there's one claim on global humanity, it must be, the East Africans now, where we came from. But anything that one looks at has had this global dimension over a very long time. To the extent that globalization is about the flow of ideas, goods, finance, services, environmental spillovers, and so on, across national borders, by definition, it requires that you have nation states in the globalization equation. Nation states are a much, much, much more recent phenomenon. And of course, they're fragmented. So the creation of 50 countries in Africa, 30 or something in Europe, are recent by timescale phenomenon. And so if one is defining globalization as flows across borders, well, then you create new nation states, you automatically create new globalization flows. And I think we need to be a little bit wary of that because we're really interested in the impact on people as much as on nation states. But this is an illustration of some of the flows from about 1870 when there were lots of nation states being defined and created. And what you see in this, just two metrics being used here. And again, anyone that tries to reduce globalization and poverty to two metrics is holding themselves up as a very, very big target because that's a pretty silly thing to do. Globalization cannot be measured only on the metric we use here, which is exports over GDP. That's just one metric. How open is an economy? How much is it trading? And this is only the export metric. And certainly poverty cannot be measured solely in terms of the number of people earning under, in this case, a dollar a day in the world. Those are just two very general measures of openness of economies or globalization exchange and of poverty. But I do want to stress that there are lots and lots of ways to measure poverty, and I'll come back to that in a few minutes, and there are lots of ways to think about how one measures globalization. But what you see from this is that exports as a share, or the openness of economies to trade, for a period in 1930 was basically where it was in 1870. And that telling you that the economies probably were more open in the late 19th century than they were in the mid 20th century, certainly on the trade measure. But the same is true, actually, if you look at capital flows and other measures. Migration flows, certainly it's true, and it's true on many, many flows. And what this is about is the reversion through the Great Depression, through World War I, which really disrupted everything, to autarky, through clothes, through isolationism, and so on. And the point I really want to make through this is that it is reversible. Globalization has been reversed, is reversed. And this isn't a new phenomenon. In the 15th century, the Chinese emperor Hun Si banned all maritime travel. Okay. In the 14th century, China was the globalizing force of the world. It was going places that the Europeans were not going. And by banning maritime travel, he basically reversed globalization dramatically for Asia for a very long time. So you can do it through policy, you can do it through wars, you can do it in different ways, but globalization certainly is reversible. And of course, it has huge leaps forward. Part of these are technology-driven. The invention of the maritime chronometer, the invention of different steam sail, the invention of internet, and so on. These things jump globalization to a new potential level. Policy changes also can do the same. The reduction in tariffs, the opening up through policy of economies, can dramatically, the allowing of the media, the global media, into your society, can dramatically change the way that these societies are globalized. So this is a policy and a technology-driven story, but it has impact from other areas, like from peace and security. The other thing that jumps out of this simple slide is that there's no simple correlation between poverty and globalization. So globalization can be reversed, it can accelerate, depending on what people do. Its impact on the poor equally is determined to a large extent by the policies that are associated with that globalization and how the globalization happens. And that's very clear from this, where you see basically until about the 1970s, the number of poor in the world was increasing. And in the last 30 years, what you've seen is, we think, for the first time in human history, a real decline in the number of people earning under $1 a day. And also, I should add, in other measures of poverty. So, for example, if you look at life expectancy at birth, that's increased by about 20 years over the last 40 years. Now, it probably took from the Stone Age till 1960 to increase life expectancy at birth by 20 years, and that has increased by about 20 years over the last 40 years. And similarly, if you look at illiteracy rates, for example, which have declined by about a half over the last 40 years, you similarly see this massive step change in the impact of economies, of opportunities on poor people. But one of the measures is the number of dollar poor as well. And this is an important measure, but it's full of its own problems, exchange rate problems, other measurement problems, and it indicates this number. Now, this decrease in the number of dollar poor happened, surely about 400 million people in the world less under a dollar a day in the year 2000 than in the year 1960. That happened despite the increase in the world's population over that period by about 2 billion.
This is 1960 to 2000.
2000, the rough numbers, I mean 65 to 2003. The, as you know, the poverty numbers and also the census numbers on population are fuzzy. But those are the sorts of orders of magnitude that one is talking about. Now, that is phenomenal. And for anyone that doesn't believe that poverty can be overcome, you just need to look at these numbers. Now, when you start to unpack these numbers and you say, where are these poor being becoming richer? Where are they escaping poverty? A large part of the story is, of course, China and India and the success of China and India. And one can go to the reasons for that. One can go to its relationship to globalization. But that's a large part of the story. And Africa, of course, is the great worry because Africa remains the place where the number of dollar poor have not declined significantly over this period. Let me turn a little bit to comparing some of the flows over time. What this does is look at the flows over the period of 1970 till about 2004. It doesn't actually, or 2003, it doesn't capture some of the absolutely most recent flows. I think there are a number of things that can be said about these numbers, and just because many of you might not be able to read them, the left-hand axis is billions of U.S. dollars, and the lines are 50, 100, 150, and these are just years along the bottom axis, starting at 1970, ending in 2002. I think the one point to make is these numbers are relatively small by global global flow standards and other standards. And they certainly were very small over the period till about 1990, all of these flows. And the flows are foreign direct investment, that's the top dark line, remittances, which is the line that bubbles up to come under foreign direct investment at the end, ODA, that's aid, which is the third line from the top, and net portfolio investment, which is the bottom line. But these flows, and if you did a similar thing for, this is flows to developing countries, if you did a similar thing for the rich countries, you would have this thing sort of at a scale which is probably 100 times above this. Not for remittances or aid, of course, but for the FDI and the portfolio flows. The scale of these flows is also, however, having said it's small, the change in these flows has been extremely rapid over the last 15 or so years. And you see that in the shape of this of these graphs and how they've turned up. Between about 1950 and 2000, exports per capita, and again, exports are only one metric, went up by about 10 times. So a 10 times increase in trade, which has, again, never happened in history. So it's gone up to about $1,000 per capita on average for the whole world of trade, which is an incredible number compared to about $40 in 1870 per trade. So much higher share of everyone's income is trade-related. I won't go into the definitions of these things now, but happy to discuss those with you. I think the other point I want to make on scale is about the orders of magnitude. Just to give you some sense of what we're talking about in flows to developing countries, the World Bank Group lends and gives in grants about $20 billion a year, so that's one component. Total aid is now about $60 billion a year, about three times that, although we will talk in a minute about does that aid actually go to developing countries. Foreign direct investment is about $150 billion, so it's about three times aid. The real story, which is not shown here, is domestic investment, people investing in their own economies. That's about $1.5 trillion. Okay. And the basic point I want to make is that all these global flows are very small compared to what people are doing for themselves in their own countries. That is the big story. What people are doing in their own countries overwhelms, in terms of the investment or the capital, the money created, anything that comes across the border for a typical country. There are exceptions, and we can talk about the exceptions. And so the real question is, how do these small flows, relative, which are typically 5% or 10% of the money circulating in an economy, how do these small flows influence the big flows, which are the domestically generated flows? That's really the question that we try to grapple with in this. And how do we make sure that these flows that we think we have some handle on, particularly the aid flows, how do we make sure that they have a much bigger impact on the poverty reduction impact, the growth impact, on those flows which are being generated within the economy? So that's the sort of dimensions of what one's talking. But even for the poorest of the poor countries, these flows tend to be, you know, one-third of income or something like that. And that's where there's very, very, very high levels of aid or remittance or other dependence is that sort of orders of magnitude. Let me quickly run through these flows one by one and try and pull out some of the most salient features of them. We put trade first because we think it's, in a way, the most important and the quickest to fix. The story about trade is really a tragedy of missed opportunity in helping poor people. And the prime reason for that is because the rich countries are, I suppose the right word is selfish, but they are basically protecting their own farmers, or thinking they're protecting their own farmers, because often what they do doesn't protect their own farmers, in ways which are extremely bad for poor people around the world. On average, a poor person, and here I'm defining poor as about living under $2 a day, pays double the tariffs to get their goods to market than someone that's richer. And that's just absolutely perverse. If you're trying to help poor people, you don't tax them double the amount you're going to tax a rich person before they can get their goods to market. And that's most probably the single most important thing in that could be done through changing policy in the rich countries to help many poor people. This is not only because of the $300 billion of subsidies and protection that the OECD countries pay, and any of you interested in these statistics should just go to the OECD website and have a look at it. They're all there, by country, by crop, by whatever you want. And if you want details on how many farmers are getting over $1 million a year in subsidies, you won't get that out of the European Union. But if you go to the U.S. Freedom of Information Act pushed websites, you will see this data by the, you know, how much Rockefeller gets in subsidies and so on. But the essential point is that rich people in rich countries, or relatively rich, are being subsidized at the direct expense of the ability of others to compete. And of course, the comparative advantage of many poor people is in products like agricultural products, like basic footwear products, like products of that nature, which their only opportunity is trying to get these things to market, to get them to market, particularly where richer people are. So this is absolutely vital. It's crazy, not only because it affects the poor directly in that they can't export, but it has many indirect effects. And I've been intimately involved in seeing some of these. I was advisor to President Mandela for 5 years and involved in setting up a regional bank, but also some Africa investment funds. We try to raise $500 million for Africa infrastructure and $50 million for small businesses in Africa. And we raised the money, but trying to spend it, we encountered many obstacles. For example, in trying to get a fish farm going on Lake Kariba, which is between Zambia and Zimbabwe, we found that we thought that it all was fine until we tried to actually do the exporting of these fish to the European Union and found absolutely insurmountable barriers. Similarly, a fascinating project with the nomads in Mauritania, who are amongst the poorest of the poor in the world, to try and turn their camels into productive resource by exporting camel cheese, which won all the prizes in Fouché and the other high-end cheese markets, but was impossible in the end due to the barriers that the European Union put in the way in terms of other regulations. And one can go on and on and on. Of course, the cotton subsidies in the U.S., cost the West Africans about $200 million a year directly in lost opportunity, and so on. And I'm not trying to point a finger at the US because the European Union and Japan are equally bad. The average cow in the European Union gets about $3 a day in payments of subsidy. In Japan, it's about $7 a day, and the average person in Africa lives under $1 a day. These are not unrelated topics. By forcing the Africans and others in poor countries to only produce certain products which are not restricted, like, say, coffee rather than grains in many countries, they also pushing commodity prices down because there's overproduction in those commodities, preventing the farmers in those countries from diversifying because you can't get into not only cocoa into chocolate, for example, because of the tariff escalation, or get out of it altogether and produce something else because of the protection on the alternative products. So it's forcing people to produce more of what they're getting increasingly bad for. It's one of the reasons why commodity prices have been going down. And it's also at the high end forcing substitution. So no one in the US uses sugar anymore in their Coca-Cola, which uses 6 teaspoons of sugar per Coke. They all use high fructose corn syrup because the subsidy structure is built around it. And that, of course, is, at the cost of those third world people that could be producing sugar for their Coke. So this is very pernicious. It affects investment, and it affects poor people directly, and it's extremely important. There are many other dimensions of trade which are important. Clearly, trade liberalization is not a panacea. The World Bank has often been hit on the head for it. I think if it does push trade liberalization as a panacea, it's making a big mistake. This is something which has to be sequenced. It's something that has to be done with the knowledge of the impact on people. When you liberalize trade markets, poor people get hurt. People in certain manufacturing areas can be hurt, and so on. So it's something that has to be done after looking at the impact. But it's not, I think, good enough to say don't liberalize trade. It has to be done, but it has to be done carefully, over time, and smartly. It also has to be done hand-in-hand with capacity building. So it's all very well talking about, you know, getting your cocoa into Chocolate, but the question is, how do you get it to your market? We started a flower farm in Ghana, which was a great idea, until the one airline that was flying to Amsterdam stopped its service, and we couldn't get the flowers to market. So the capacity, the cold storage capacity, the knowledge capacity, and so on, is absolutely vital. And what some people call the capacity dimension, or trade for aid, is what another way of sometimes looking at this, is extremely vital. Finally, there are certain parts of the trade debate which need more control, not less, and that's particularly trade in arms, trade in illicit goods, and so on. And there's a fascinating book that's just been brought out by a guy called Moises Naim, and it's called Illicit. And it's very difficult, obviously, to quantify illicit trade and what it does, but he tries to do that. And it really is staggering about some of the things that are traded that shouldn't be traded, you know, from sex slaves to illicit arms and so on. All countries, but particularly the countries that manufacture the arms and so on, have a responsibility to ensure that tighter control over these sorts of illicit trades, which are so destructive. Over 500,000 people a year die as a result of small arms, and these are the sort of things which should not be traded without more control. So it's very important to differentiate between these different things. Also, of course, the conflict, what people call conflict diamonds, conflict oil, ensuring greater transparency around trade is absolutely vital. So ensuring that people that try to trade their diamonds for guns to overthrow their country is not something which can be done with impunity. That sort of control over trade. Publish what you pay, other initiatives like that, the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, other sorts of initiatives which try and highlight where the money goes from trade, and to ensure that it doesn't go to Swiss bank accounts, but goes to development, are absolutely part of this project. So ensuring that the benefits of trade are not captured either illicitly or illegally, but even by a small elite. Letting people know where the money goes, make sure it is mobilized for development, is absolutely vital. So trade is complicated, it's important, it's something that all of you benefit and lose from every day. You are most probably paying about £700 a year more than you should be paying for your food, for your clothing, and for other articles because they are so protected. At the same time, you might be benefiting some people, but you are most probably also impacting very negatively on people in developing countries. So no one can say that they're immune to the trade debate. You all are wearing products, using products from multiple countries, and it's a good idea to get to know what's happening in the manufacture of these and so on. It's also, of course, something that's happened with another dimension of the globalization debate, which is knowledge. So you know whether the products you made are made by child laborers in a certain country or not. And consumers are getting much more active, which is a very good thing about this. It's putting pressure through the globalization story on ensuring that rights are more widely spread around the world. Finance is another key dimension of the flow. The financial flows, again, are small relative to some of the other flows, and they're very erratic. They're very volatile flows. Countries cannot rely on external financing, should not rely on external financing, but they can be extremely useful. And it's particularly important that countries get a much more blended form, and I'll come back to what that means, of external financing. Most of these financial flows go to the middle-income countries, not to the low-income countries. And within the low-income countries, most of them go to a very small number of countries, particularly those which are mineral exporters or oil exporters. And that is a problem. So many countries are virtually not in the capital markets for any intents and purposes. There's been an evolution in these financial flows from commercial debt or bank lending to the issuance of bonds and other forms of debt to equity, and this diversification, I think, is a very healthy thing. Relying only on bank lending is a very dangerous proposition. And, of course, it's short-term. One of the key things about investing in infrastructure, say, a road or a water line, is that the asset is a very long asset. Typically, a road exists for 50 years or 75 years or longer. And so what you don't want is that everyone that's using it in the next few years to have to pay for it. You want to depreciate it over the lifetime of that asset. And so getting long-term capital is extremely important, but also getting long-term capital that makes sense so that you don't, say, pay in dollars and find that your currency is depreciated, And that you're paying more and more every year as you pay back your dollar loan. So thinking through how countries finance their assets, what the relationship is to different types of financial flows is extremely important for countries. What this graph, and it's again for those that can't see, this is percent of GDP on the left-hand axis. You see very small numbers there. 1, 2, 3, 4 is those lines, those horizontal lines. And this is the years from 1970 to 2004. The top graph is middle-income countries. The bottom graph is low-income countries. What this highlights is not only the volatility, some growth trend, and how middle-income countries increasingly are capturing most of this, these capital flows that are going on. These are net flows after deducting repayment, where there is repayment. These flows have moved from the period up to the Mexican crisis in 1982, the Asian crisis of 97. They're now around 4-5% of GDP from being around 2-3% of GDP, but still small. And it goes back to the point I made earlier. Basically, you've got to mobilize your own capital to do things. Relying on external flows is only going to be a small part of the problem. One cannot look at these flows without also thinking about what people call capital flight. That's an important issue, and how to deal with it is very important. What share of Africa's wealth is outside Africa? Maybe 40%? What share of the Middle East's wealth is outside the Middle East? Maybe 40%? And so on. That's a very big number if one's worried about finding money for development. You're saying almost half of the wealth creation is outside the country, outside the region or the country. That is a big issue. How you get it back, why it flows, how you control it, whether you should control it, those are the issues we touch on. And of course, it is important to bring this capital back. It's important to ensure if your own citizens don't believe in investing in your own country, it's very difficult to imagine that foreigners are going to. And so how you convince people not to take their capital away is an important issue. Although, of course, everyone has the ability to move capital now. The rating agencies also play a very big role increasingly in these markets. And what the rating agencies do, the question of whether they are contributing to the trends in a positive way or negative way, where there's herding around rating agency activity, is important. On balance, the rating agencies provide much-needed information. They go into depth on different projects, on different possibilities, and they provide information which you just can't get anywhere else. The good news is that they're also providing it increasingly on projects which they never used to. For example, there's something like 10 countries in Africa now which are rated by the rating agencies compared to, I think, 2, 5 years ago. So there's progress, not enough, but there's progress, and we're encouraging it in that direction. But a lot of people that invest rely on the rating agencies before they invest. So if you don't have a credit rating, basically it's like going to a bank. If you don't have a credit rating, they won't lend you money. So getting the rating agencies to widen their horizons to do more, but also to try and stand back a bit and take a deeper look at the societies they're involved in is, I think, part of the objective of anyone interested in facilitating broader financial flows to developing countries. Aid is a very recent financial flow. It really is something which developed, depending how you define it, because, of course, there was the colonial transfer of resources from the colonial powers to their colonies. They built things, they did things. I wouldn't really call that aid in this context, but some people do. But really, it's a post-1960s phenomenon. It's something which, again, like most globalization flows, one can't make too many prior statements about. A lot of aid has been disastrously wasted. $10 billion went to the Congo, and its per capita GDP halved. So one has to ask whether that was productively used aid, and I could give you 100 different other examples of wasted aid. A lot of this was due to the Cold War, where basically politics, military allegiances, and other considerations, drug eradication, and so on, guided the decisions of where aid should go. And aid also typically went to friendly powers, often dictators, who might move the aid elsewhere. So the question about is aid effective has to be looked at in the question of where is that aid going? Is it going to countries where poor people live? That's generally a very important consideration if you want it to have an impact on poverty. And if it is going to countries where poor people live, is it going within those countries to projects, programs, activities that will make have an impact on the poor. And so that's the sort of screen that is a prior before one can talk about the value of aid. The really good news is that aid effectiveness has increased dramatically since about 1990, since the end of the Cold War. It's partly because that Cold War dynamic around aid has largely ended, although there's still a lot of aid going for political reasons and other reasons, but much less so than in the Cold War. It's partly as a result of that reason, but it's also because governments have become much more accountable, both globally and nationally. So there's been a wave of democratization around the world in the 1990s. In 1990, something like one-third of the African countries were democratic. Now something like two-thirds are. Similarly, Eastern Europe, Central Asia, and so on. So Latin America, similar tendencies. And that has made governments more accountable. It's made them more accountable to their people and to a broader range of international actors. And that is absolutely vital. Information flows have improved. There's been a huge improvement in aid coordination and so on. There really has been a sea change in the way that aid is thought about, is given, and is mobilized. That's the good news. The really bad news is that despite that, despite the fact that developing countries have never been better governed, despite the fact that we are now convinced that aid is better targeted than it ever was, aid numbers actually declined in the period 1990 to 2000. So in 1960, the rich countries were spending about a third of 1% of their income on aid. By 2000, it had gone down to about a fifth of 1%. Okay, this is 0.22% of budgets spent on aid. Tiny fractions. People have really weird ideas about how much money is spent on aid. You know, in the U.S., people think that aid is like budget number three, when it's really budget number 300 in the high priority list of what the government spends money on. So people basically are spending about three Starbucks coffees a year per capita in the rich countries on aid, and they think that that's too much. That is less than they were spending in 1960 when they were spending about four Starbucks coffees per year on aid, although the aid is much more effectively used. So this is a very important question of perceptions, of reality catching up with perceptions, and so on. This works also in a per capita sense. So although Africa is now better governed and better able to manage aid than ever before, and although aid does go more to poor people than it ever did, in 1990, the average African was getting $35, and in the year 2000, they were getting half of that, $17, despite this improvement in everything. And so if you're in a developing country, you have to ask yourself, you know, what do I get from the international community for all the progress that we're showing? We're certainly not getting more aid on average. And I think that is a real concern, and it does draw into question part of this global governance, part of legitimacy. The good news is that from about the year 2000, there's been a new energy around aid and what are called the Millennium Development Goals, the UN Compact, the Monterey Conference. There's been a whole series of global events driven out of the UN, which has really, I think, turned the corner on this. And now you will see, for the first time, I think, in the coming years, a real change in aid. There is a projection that aid will double in the period to 2010. We have to see what's delivered. We also have to unpack the numbers. A lot of aid is debt relief. A lot of aid goes to countries that might not still need it as much as, say, the poor Africans need it. But there is a new commitment, and that is very, very exciting. There is a real new trend in aid. It's essential that aid actually goes to poor people. About half of aid never even goes to the countries concerned. It goes to technical assistance. It goes to pay for people to go on great master's courses, like those that Robert runs, on development, and so on. That is assistance to countries, but, you know, let's not imagine that these aids are flows that ministers can use to build a health clinic. The other important thing is that aid needs to be coordinated. It shouldn't be a flag-waving exercise where a minister wants to be seen with a baby outside a clinic, so they put their own flag, give their own money, and that's uncoordinated to whoever's going to support the power, electricity, the roads, get people there. aid needs to be mobilized behind government budgets in a transparent way. So that is absolutely vital. It needs to be predictable. You can't turn tap on and off. And what you see in these flows here on this diagram is how the tap gets turned on and off over time. It's very difficult to develop a health or education program if you don't know what's happening next year in terms of your commitments. And it's very important it's predictable, that it's transparent, that it's mobilized collectively, and that there's harmonization amongst the aid agencies. And again, there is huge progress in these areas. So there's a lot of good news. But keep up the pressure. The Make Poverty History campaign was very much about raising political awareness in the rich countries, in this Bono's Live Aid and so on, Geldof's work. These are very important things in mobilizing politicians' opinion, in keeping the pressure on us in the international institutions and others to do the right thing. And so I think it's very important. One of the concerns about 2005 being the year of development, particularly focused on Africa in that year, is what's happening in 2006. Is that energy being sustained? Are people moving on to the next story? And sustaining this momentum behind development is part of the problem. So keep your attention spans, and if you're committed to these things, it's extremely important that they don't get that sustainability gets maintained. Migration. As I said, when I come back next year, if I'm invited, I'd like to talk only about migration. The more I look at migration, the more I see this as perhaps the most fundamental dimension of all of this globalization. I'm sure many of you, all of you, if you go back far enough, aren't from the UK. Those of you that think you are should read a book called Bloody Foreigners, which is really a tremendous book about how the English have invented their identity and reinvented it and reinvented and reinvented it over time. But generally they were French or Scottish or British or, not British, anything but British over time.
Who is the author?
I think it's Robert Winder, but if you Google Bloody Foreigners, you'll see it. Yeah, thanks. This is just one snapshot. I mean, on Britain, which, you know, we're in Britain, so it's important, particularly because most people think that they are sort of the originals from their country. I don't think there was a British king or queen that could speak English as a first language till 10-something, right? What is highlighted in this, but lots and lots and lots of other literature, is how people have always escaped poverty and found opportunity through basically migration. That has historically been the globalizing way to escape poverty. And that's most probably why all of our ancestors moved from where they moved, originally out of Africa, around the world. It's the reason people move, to find opportunity. Now, when you create nation states and you block that opportunity, you are changing the dynamics of globalization in a very fundamental way. And basically what you're often doing is trapping the poor, because they are the least mobile. They can't jump on the plane. They can't get a grocery to LSE to do an MSc or anything else. You're trapping the poor in a particular geographical space, which is unlikely to be able to sustain them in a way that another space could. You're hugely confining their opportunities. And if you look at the history, even the recent history of Europe, you know, between 1870 and 1900, something like 3 million Europeans, 25 million Europeans, I've got my orders of magnitude wrong here, which was something like 25 to 30% of the European population migrated. I mean, it's mind-boggling now to think of a third of Britain getting up and walking away somewhere. But that's the sort of thing that was happening over those periods. People were basically finding opportunity elsewhere. And that was driven by the steamships coming on. Many of them went to America, to the US and Canada, but many of them went elsewhere. And you can find around it. So not only Europeans defined all the way to Russia, broad Europe at the time. They went because they were persecuted. They went because of pogroms. They went for many reasons, but they also went for economic opportunity. And they tended to be the younger people that were going. And what I've increasingly realized from this literature is that that was the globalizing way to escape poverty and to create new opportunities. But now with nation states, the dynamics are totally different. And so the question is, how has this changed the poverty dynamic? The creation of 50 nation states in Africa is obviously a fundamental part of the story. Africans used to migrate to where opportunity is. They can no longer do that. You know, what is the relationship between migration opportunities and those trapped in poverty in Burkina Faso, for example? So these are very, very important and complex issues. And whenever you talk about national identity and nation states, you're putting your finger on something which is very, very complex and very psychological, obviously. But it is vital. So the question is, how in this world of nation states, and an increasing number of nation states now, over 200, how do we deal with the migration issues? And obviously it's hard. It's on in the papers every day, and I had jet lag and couldn't sleep this morning. At 1 o'clock it was on the TV. There's a very good story on illegal African migrants into the UK on a TV channel this morning at 1 o'clock. So it's a very hot topic. The crucial thing is to think about it in a way that will support development in developing countries. And too much of this debate is a protectionist response from the rich countries. The amount of research and money going into this is growing rapidly, but just one institute, I think, that's recently been established in the UK has more money going into research on this issue than all of the spend in developing countries put together on migration. So there's an overwhelming focus and needed focus on research, on policy thinking on migration, but in terms of the money going in, the thinking going in, this is largely dominated by the rich countries and what to do about keeping people out. There are multiple dimensions to migration. People tend to focus on brain drain. That's crucially important. What happens when half your teachers leave, half your nurses and doctors leave, as has happened in many countries, Malawi, Haiti, many other countries? How do you sustain yourself? How do you overcome HIV/AIDS in those situations? Should you be paying for their education? Should you have education systems where taxpayers pay, say, $500,000 to educate someone and they leave as soon as they're educated? What's the policy response to that? Do countries have the right to control movement of people, educated people, or is it a basic human right to go wherever you want and to have that education? These are very complex and difficult questions. We suggest some issues around them. But brain drain is important. It's important not only because of the skills, but also because we know from all the endogenous growth literature and economics and elsewhere that the people that tend to migrate tend to be the change agents in their own societies. And when you have floods of people leaving, what is the implications for the political process, for the transformation processes, for the poverty reduction process back to home? Not just because of the skills, but because of how they would have been active in politics, in mobilizing people, in changing their societies. So when you escape, what is the role? Of course, diaspora, brain waste. All of you have been in taxis, I'm sure, where you've met some guy with a PhD who's driving a taxi. I hope it happens to none of you, but it's very typical. Often these people are refugees from some country, Eritrea, Afghanistan, wherever, but many times they're not. Brain waste is a major issue, and what does one do about it? And then, of course, there's a whole many other debates, but there's the remittances debate. What this graphic shows, and I'm racing now because Robert's looking at me as if I'm running out of time, what this shows is something else which is very important to recognize, which is migration is also, like all other globalization forces, not a one-way street. It goes up and down. This is migration into the US. What it shows is that basically there are periods where lots of migrants are let in and there are periods where the tap is turned off. And it goes up and down, and one can explain it partly through economics, but not mainly through economics. It's mainly explained through other factors, particularly political mobilization domestically by people who feel injured. What is the evidence on people losing their jobs or their salaries being reduced through migration? The evidence is extremely weak. In fact, what the evidence tends to show, evidence that I think is now increasingly taken seriously, is that migrants are the dynamic force for many economies. And the question is, what happens if you don't let your migrants in? Not only because they're doing unskilled work, but particularly also the dynamics of internet. And if you look around the UK or you look around inside and say, let's just take a look at the innovators in science, technology, arts, and say, where do they come from or where do their grandfathers come from? You get the sort of answer to those sorts of questions. So the dynamic endogenous growth and other growth elements of this are absolutely vital. The final penultimate chapter of the book is on ideas. I'm as equally excited about ideas as I am as migration. This is even less understood. In the end, it's all about ideas. It's all about how one's thinking changes as a result of exposure in an interchange. That's really what drives civilization, what drives development. It's what is, in a way, what differentiates humans from all others. And it is the vital thing. If you do a thought experiment and say, let's take down the Berlin Wall, as was taken down. If the West did no investment in East Germany, what would be more important on East Germany, the infrastructure or water or something was going to put in, or the flow of information? And one can do the similar experiment, say, for North Korea now. Let's say that Korea becomes unified. What's the biggest impact on North Korea? It's going to be through people's exposure to ideas. And that is going to create the opportunities, the excitement and so on, more than anything else. It's ideas that drive development in the end. Not all ideas are good, and the flow of ideas is not necessarily good. One can think of many bad ideas. Nazism is obviously one extreme. There are many other bad ideas. One is not saying that more power to ideas. It's not that simple. Ideas need to be contested. There needs to be, through this process, the contestation of ideas. There also needs to be support for ideas. One of the big debates in globalization is around intellectual property, and whether intellectual property rights restrict or increase the flow of ideas. And for my interest, particularly, the question is, what's the impact on developing countries? I think most of the evidence is suggesting now, firstly, that a lot of developing countries' ideas are not covered, like indigenous knowledge products, and secondly, that the legislation or regulation has sort of gone ahead of our knowledge. And if you read the IP literature, intellectual property literature, what you see is a lot of people saying, even in the US, that the patent system, the legislation system, the control, has gone beyond understanding of whether this is good or bad. And this isn't just for things like HIV, AIDS, drugs, and the whole generics debate around that. This is more generally. And so one of the things we suggest in the book is the need to step back and put a bit of a break on this and look at it in a much deeper way. And when Pascal Lamy comes tomorrow, whenever he's coming, you can ask him questions about that. I don't think he agrees. And by the way, that isn't official World Bank policy. The World Bank doesn't have policy on that particular issue. Let me just summarize very, very briefly on what we're saying. On all of these key dimensions, there is work to be done. There are policies to be made, and there's coherence to be driven between these different dimensions. It doesn't make sense through your aid budget to invest in the building of a school or a health clinic if through your migration policies you're recruiting all the teachers and nurses from that society. That's coherence or incoherence. It doesn't make sense to say to developing countries, on their financial flows, you know, don't be corrupt on your aid flows, and then to give tax deductions at home to your companies, which, if they bribe officials, which many countries still do. That is incoherence. So it's the coherence between domestic policies and global policies and between these different dimensions of globalization and economic flows that is so vital. In trade, I'm just going to hit a lot of buttons now because I'm running out of time. We can come back to them. The key policy changes which are needed are to reduce the subsidies, to give greater market access to developing countries, to support much greater capacity building, and to focus not just on what one can do, increase in trade, but also help countries controlling illicit trade, which is so destabilizing to many of their economies, from arms, hazardous wastes, sex, illicit sex, and so on. On finance, the basic position we take is that there needs to be a very nuanced approach on finance. We are not for immediate capital liberalization on the capital account on countries. We believe the heterodox, or what's often called the heterodox approach, is the right approach. We believe that there should be blended standards. That there should be a blended approach, that countries should be able to access different sorts of capital, they should have more choice, and we should facilitate this greater choice. That reliance on commercial banking or any one source, world banking or any other, is wrong and bad for countries. And so broadening this is crucial. The other issues around standards, and that's really about money laundering and around the Basel Convention and others, and there's major questions, but we'll come back to those hopefully in discussion. On aid, increase its effectiveness, untie it so it's not linked to sending your own tractors to a country or sending your own technicians to a country, ensuring that the results are transparent, and also harmonizing so that, for example, all donors need to support similar sorts of activities. The average Tanzanian requirement is something like 12,000 quarterly reports for aid budgets. The ministers take around something like 500 visitors a month. Can you imagine trying to run your economy and keep the donors happy? It's really impossible for many of these people. And so the question is, how can the donors be much more helpful in organizing themselves in a way that will be helpful to the country so that ministers and civil servants can actually get on with the job that they should be getting on with? Obviously, debt relief is vital. More debt relief. Debt relief, and we haven't touched on it much. This is a vital dimension. There's been huge progress through the recent G8 on this, but that needs to be sustained. And it also needs to be done in a way that doesn't only give debt relief to those that were in debt, and no new flows to those that weren't in debt. So how do you reward those that never took on excess debt is a key question in this. And predictability, I mentioned. Migration, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, regularizing, opening, dealing with the brain drain remittances. And finally, on ideas, a lot of what the ideas debate about is the voice and diversity in voice, allowing developing countries and within countries a greater range of people to have their views expressed, to engage in debates. Intellectual IPs, intellectual property, I mentioned that. Technology transfer is absolutely vital as part of this. A lot of this is bundled in investment, but it can be unbundled, and there are many ways to support it. KM is knowledge management. I didn't have time to deal with this. It's a very complicated subject. Again, a subject in which there's much more heat than light in the literature. But clearly, how does one bring the universal knowledge of, say, getting a girl into school to, for example, the Burundian education minister? How does one mobilize the global experience in doing things effectively, what's worked, what hasn't worked, to the effect of development? And that is part of the knowledge management. It's something we're very bad at. We keep reinventing things. We have very weak institutional memories. We have very weak capacity to learn from other places. Not only on what works, but we honestly talk about what hasn't worked. And we as bad at the World Bank as anyone else is in this. And then, of course, access. How much people have access to ideas. That's about freedom of information. It's about the media and open media. It's about internet and broadband. It's about it. This isn't only a question of policy. Do you allow it? It's also a question of technology. And if I may, don't get scared. I won't spend time on this, Robert. But this reflects telephone mainlines, mobile phones, internet users between low, middle, and high-income countries. And there's a huge disparity. And obviously, if you don't have the basic technology, it's very difficult to be connected and to make use of a global world. So that is a very, very important thing. Without plugging the book, this is clearly just a skimming of the surface of these debates. These ideas are ours. They are not those of the 184 shareholders of the bank who would never have signed off on it if they were given the opportunity, so they weren't. But we are allowed to engage in individual research. That's one of the good things in terms of knowledge within the bank. And I think they need to move. They will move through debate in areas like this. Clearly, anyone that ever says they have the answer to something has lost the story. This is all about evolution. And the quicker we can evolve our ideas, the smarter we can be, and the quicker we are able to bring those ideas to those that need them in a convincing way, I think the more effective we will be ensuring that development happens. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We have about 25 minutes for questions, comments, and so on. And while you're collecting your thoughts, I want to take up the emphasis that you gave to ideas and make a couple of comments. You say on page 15, ideas are the most powerful influence on development. Ideas are the most powerful influence on development. And I have two comments. One is that if you look at the list of references at the back of your book, a long list of references, I would guess that 90% of the authors live in two countries, either the United States or in Britain. And on the face of it, it's surprising that you limit the ideas on which you draw for the book to such a narrow base of places where ideas are generated. That's comment number one. Comment number two is, when you say ideas are the most powerful influence on development, the The obvious question is most powerful in relation to what else? What other possible influences on development are ideas being contrasted with? And one of the striking things about the book is that there is, as I think you've hinted here, virtually no reference to things like power, power structures, possible exploitative power relations between countries, between groups. This just doesn't feature. It might be argued that, contrary to what you and also Keynes said, because Keynes agrees with you, although he did contrast the power of ideas with the power of vested interests and said ideas mattered more than vested interests, it might be argued that at least in some contexts very relevant to development, vested interests are more important than ideas. For example, the TRIPS agreement, the agreement on intellectual property. Nobody justifies the TRIPS agreement. It came about only because of the power of big pharmacy and Hollywood and software. They were the ones who were able to drive this agreement, which is a complete nonsense from any theory of economic justice, through the WTO. That's a clear example where vested interests dominated the power of ideas, I would have thought. In any case, some comments on that. Do you want to reply to either of those two either of those 2 points, and then we'll open it up. Maybe you want to.
I think on the source of references point, that's a very good point. Well, both points are good, but I think that really reflects the problem. I think 90% of what we drew on is, you know, maybe it's 80%, but a very high share of it is from those countries, mainly because that's where people are writing about it in languages that we understand. And I speak a little bit of Spanish, French, and Portuguese, but it's a lot of work for me to work in those languages, and my co-author speaks none of them. So that's one sort of obvious question. The other is the monopoly within many of these debates of certain groups. If you go to any of the economic journals or so on, you'll find a similar domination from this. And within those, it's worse. It's a problem which I think transcends simply where people are from. For example, we have a young professional program at the World Bank, which is meant to recruit, say, 20 to 30 of the brightest people interested in development to come and work at the bank a year, and we get lots of applications, and diversity is a criteria where people are from. And we are diverse. They might come from India, China, Africa, everywhere else. But where you look at where their degrees are from, that's a different story. You know, most of them are from LSE, Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, Yale, and so on. And so even if you come from a diverse place, you sort of go into the big mincemeat machine that the top institutions have. Because if you want to study subjects and you're speaking English in those, that's where you're likely to go. I hope this changes over time. The huge explosion in education in China, in India, and in many places creates that. I mean, it really would be a sign of huge failure if there isn't the change over time in this respect. But I think it's a good point. We are still very, very narrow in what we draw on. On the question on power relations, by the way, the web sources are difficult to know where they come from, some of them that we use. And that's a whole new dimension of referencing. I mean, if you use Wikipedia as a source, which I hope you don't use too much, it's difficult to know where people are that are writing, for example. The power relation issue, ideas versus vested, is right. The only thing that I suppose I'm enough of an optimist to believe in is that ideas will overcome vested interests in the end. And that's why one fights. I mean, that's why one fights in the realm of ideas, because you believe through the power of argument, and if you convince enough people at enough different levels, locally, nationally, globally, that good ideas will drive out bad ideas. If you believe that bad ideas are going to win, then that's sort of a very pessimistic starting point, but I think history does demonstrate, and the evolution, civilization evolution, that basically good ideas in the end drive out bad ideas. But more people need to be focusing on this issue and mobilizing the ideas and grabbing them, I think, and debating them.
Okay, I think we don't have to stick to the contours of Ian's talk if you wish to ask him questions like, how does he find the transition from the ideas of President Wolfensohn to the ideas of President Wolfowitz? That would be a perfectly legitimate question to ask. I want to call first on...
Can I just say on that particular comment by my esteemed chair that would... You can ask any question you want, but I also have the right not to answer every question you ask. And that... I would really, and sort of was part of this, of the ground rules of this discussion, that this is going to be about the ideas in the book. So I'd prefer not to have long conversations about particularly individuals, certainly within the World Bank. But you know, try and see. Maybe I'll soften up.
He is the Vice President for External Affairs. I want to call on Jeff Powell. Powell. He's the head of the Bretton Woods Project, which is a small NGO based in London, which monitors the World Bank and the IMF. Jeff.
Thank you, Robert. And thank you, Dr. Golden, for that very interesting lecture. I wanted to make a point about trade and a question for you about finance. On the trade front, you said if the World Bank pushes trade liberalization as a panacea, it's making a big mistake. And here I would want to suggest that it really shouldn't be a question of if. The World Bank has pushed trade liberalization and continues to do so. And it has made a big mistake. I think interesting in this respect is the very recent evaluation that was done by the bank's evaluation unit, which there are many highlights. It's very worth reading. But one of the most interesting highlights is it said that bank pressure through structural adjustment programs for what they describe as premature import liberalization has had negative impacts on domestic industrial development. Now, that's veiled language, but I would return to an UNCTAD study that was done in 2002 across Africa, where they said that bank-induced structural adjustment import liberalization has led to a hollowing out of the manufacturing sector in Africa. So I think we can safely conclude that the bank has pushed liberalization. It was a mistake. The question is, will it stop? Now, the question
that's
on...
liberalization in developing countries, yeah, as distinct from liberalization of the agricultural sector in developed countries.
Yes, there's a whole different point about the advocacy issue, which I won't go into. On the finance point, a question. You said, and I very much agree with it, that we can't be seen to be turning the tap on or off, that volatility is a key issue when it comes to aid. Now, in the last 6 months, Mr. Wolfowitz must have a sore wrist because he's been turning that tap on and off with a pretty regular basis. From Chad, Kenya, India, Bangladesh, Argentina, Yemen, I mean, we can name countries across the world. And a lot of people would want to point out, they wouldn't necessarily want to condemn him for this, but they'd want to also point out what has been the bank's contribution to the issue of corruption. And here, very quickly, through structural adjustment, what's been the impact on underpayment of civil servants? Has the bank done enough to discourage northern corporations that are part of the bribery process? And most recently, and most explicitly, there's been a very good U.S. News and World Report that's come out finding a bank staff member who's been implicated with having his hand in the cookie jar in a very major way. And so I'd like to hear, what will the bank be doing to change its practices, and how will you in External Affairs be messaging this, because we've got a real battle on our hands if we're going to convince northern donor countries to stay in the game.
Jeff, what is the website of the Bretton Woods organization?
You're very good at the hard sell. It's BrettonWoodsProject.org.
I think on the trade as a panacea, I think the first general point I'd make about the World Bank Group, and many of you might have been in touch with it in different ways, is that this is a group of over 10,000 people operating in over 90 countries. In a rather decentralized way, and a lot of things happen in different ways, and have happened over time. And I've only been at the bank for 5 years, so it's very easy for me to say we screwed up a lot in the past, and I'm happy to say that. And I think everyone in the bank would agree. that the bank has made mistakes. I mean, the whole point about the ideas discussion is that if you ever begin to think that you haven't made mistakes, you've really lost the story on ideas, because ideas is really about learning from the mistakes, and so the first thing is to look at the mistakes in the eye. So I think it's very important that the bank is more open about mistakes it's made, that everyone is as well in that. So the others have made mistakes too. And the countries have made huge mistakes. And it's politicians always condemn the past, but that's part of the democratic process, is that you can move that debate along. On the trade as a panacea, the bank has gone, you know, through cycles. And one of the things in the book, which if you get to it, you'll see, is we spend about 10 pages on going through the evolution in development thinking, the thinking around what works and what doesn't work in development. And there has been this huge swing from the state being the key driver in the 1960s and 70s to the market being the panacea, get your prices right sort of argument, structural adjustment, get the macro right in the 70s, 80s, partly in response to the oil crisis and huge macro instability in developing countries and in the world, but partly as a result of ideology. It was the time of Thatcher, the time of Reagan, the time of Kohl, and so on. So there was lots of different dimensions to this changed ideology. And I think that the 1990s, the late 1990s, the early part of the 21st century, has been a period in which a much more, I'm sounding as if we got our ideas right, but a much more nuanced view of the role of the state in the market, that the state is very imperfect, that markets are also very imperfect, that it's not the Washington consensus which only focuses on certain flows, that institutions matter, that governance matters, that all sorts of things matter that are not in the core Washington consensus. So I think there's been this huge pendulum swing, and the trade debate has been caught up in that pendulum swing. So that in the period of the 80s, when it was get your prices right, a lot of people did think that simple liberalization of trade would solve a lot of problems. I think they were fundamentally wrong. And I think most people in the bank think they were wrong. Did we do projects which pushed that or discussed that with government? Most probably yes. Do we still do that? And is that still the general message of the bank? I think if you look at the recent documents from the bank, you'll see something. You'll hear something which I haven't emphasized. I've emphasized because you're sitting here in a rich country, and I think you can impact on rich country policies, and I'm trying to change the debate in Britain and the rich countries. But you will also see an emphasis on the need for developing countries to focus on reform. There are a lot of tariffs and other controls on trade in developing countries which are wrong. Trade reform is as important or more important for developing countries because the people are poorer. Protecting an industry, you know, having a light bulb manufacturer in Zambia with huge state subsidies, is that a good idea? Is it something that we should be supporting import substitution in Zambia? And I don't believe we should. I believe there's more productive use of government's money in Zambia than supporting light bulb manufacturing. And so if the bank would, in its discussions with government, have that discussion and say, use your money elsewhere. So I don't want to say that it's wrong to be against import substitution. Sometimes it's right. But what's important if those workers are going to be made unemployed is to know that there's going to be a bigger story, that there's going to be a way in which their lives are looked after, and that the benefits overall in the economy, that money saved from that subsidy will go to education or health or other development dimensions. And that relates to, I guess, to the on and off point on corruption. There has been, in recent months, a much greater focus on something which has been there a long time. I mean, I think Jim Wolfenson, who recruited me to the World Bank and who was Wolfowitz's predecessor. I know these names are very confusing because of the four-letter overlap. Jim Wolfenson, you know, was the person I think remembered for talking about the cancer of corruption and bringing that into the World Bank and into the development debate. It was not acceptable. I think today in the UK Parliament, a group of members of Parliament are pushing the British government to talk about this issue. So this is still a very difficult issue for donors to come to. It's a new issue. It's, again, part of, I think, the benefits of the ending of the Cold War, where anything goes if it's our friend sort of attitude seemed to prevail very strongly.
I think there's a much stronger focus on governance, on where does the money go? Is it going to the poor people? Is it going to the projects? And I think that's right. Now, if there are members of the World Bank Group or any organization that have been corrupt, they should be dealt with in a fair and disciplined way. There needs to be the evidence. The cases need to be proven, and it needs to take the course through. The World Bank has been very active in dismissing people that have been found to be corrupt, and also in sanctioning companies. I think we have something like, and it's on our website, 200 companies that we've sanctioned that cannot work with us because of this. We're also trying to widen this to be more coordinated with others. So let's say we don't give them the money, but then the African Development Bank does. Now, is that something we should be working on as well? So this is a very big issue. But one of the reasons it's important is not only because corruption takes money away from poor people and the purposes it's meant to go to, but it also changes the nature of the debate in the rich countries. If you look at the polls that we conduct, is why do people not want to give more aid money in the UK or in the US or anywhere? And over 50% of the response is because people think that aid is corrupt. This is a primary reason that people give. I'm not saying it's right. I don't think that aid is that corrupt. I think it's actually much less corrupt. But I think being hard on governance and corruption is important as part of the mobilization of more aid and as part of getting the results out of the aid agenda. So yes, there have been a series of cases. I think you're right to point to the need for this over time to be seen as part of a sustained process. Many of those cases have already been reversed or are being reversed. But it's a very, very important issue. If we think our money's not going to the purpose we think it should be, if it was agreed to be going to, but going to corrupt officials or corrupt others, corrupt companies, that is something that we have to act upon, and I think it's very important. I think that's basically the questions.
I think it is surprising how little corruption there has been amongst World Bank officials over the past 20 years or so. I mean, the opportunities for corruption are there all around, and what is striking is how little there has been.
I think just on that, we have something like, out of a staff of 10,000 or more, we have something like 40 cases under investigation, and one person, I think, currently where there's a high probability of. So it is very small. I think it's the right point to make.
So, yes.
My question is rather broad, and it's touched a bit on what you've said already, so I'll leave it to you to pick it apart.
Can you just speak slowly and loudly? Can you identify yourself?
Sure. My name is Justina, and I'm in the Politics of the World Economy program.
Politics of the World Economy, yeah.
Yeah.
So speak loudly and slowly.
Okay.
At the back have to hear.
My question is rather broad and large, and it touches on a couple of things that you've said. So I'll leave it up to you to pick it apart and answer it as you'd like. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the impact of globalization on national policy autonomy and policy capacity in developing countries.
Yep. That's a small question. It has to do with what is the impact of globalization on policy autonomy of developing country governments.
Yeah, I think it's Tom Friedman, right, in... Is it The World Is Flat or in Lexus and Olive Tree? I've got it in the book. Who talks about globalization creating a straitjacket for countries. The idea being that basically these forces are so strong that it's taken away national autonomy. I think that's missing a large part of the picture. And part of what the book is about is just demonstrating how countries can exercise control over their thing. There are things which are very, very difficult to control, but there are still cases, and I suppose North Korea is one of the extreme examples, where you can basically shut out the world and do your own thing. So it's still at the extreme possible. There are many countries that exercise discretion over all sorts of dimensions of in fact, all the dimensions of globalization, and very few countries exercise no discretion. Even the most liberal and open economies exercise discretion on many dimensions, either through rules, standards, regulations, controls, and so on. Migration is the obvious one that all countries exercise huge autonomy through. It's not always effective, But that's a separate matter, how they're able to become effective. But there is a lot of effective control. So I don't think it's taken away autonomy. It's changed, clearly, the rules of the game. It's globalized the game. So what people do now is known around the world pretty instantaneously. And it's made people, I think, in that process, more accountable. It's very difficult to have secrets in this world. Or to do things that others will not get to know about. And I think that's to me been a huge liberating force for the world, and it's one of the reasons I'm optimistic on ideas, is I think ideas are churning now and are being moved around the world across a greater number of people with greater frequency, with greater interaction, in a way that's absolutely unprecedented, thanks to the internet and other dimensions. There's also worries around control, which aren't just national, but, you know, if you have a situation where three companies own 900 TV stations and you don't have much choice, well, that's an issue around ideas, clearly. So how governments regulate and play this to nurture the positive forces is extremely important.
Yes, yes. Somebody up in the gallery next.
It's a related question, really, to the last one. I work in the area.
Can you just identify yourself?
Yeah,
and let me say before you begin that up in the video room, some of you may want to come down because there are now some seats here. So do come down if you'd like to. Can you identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm Rachel Tiley. I work in the area of organizing events for the oil and gas sector. We're organizing events around sustainable development, local content. And I'm just interested to hear your take on the relationship between the globalization forces and the trend towards demands for local content in exploration for oil and gas. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah.
Can you just repeat the question?
Yeah, I think the question, correct me if I didn't get it right, but I think the question is the relationship between globalization and demands for local content. I mean,
especially in oil and gas.
Especially in oil and gas. I didn't hear the tail end of that. I mean, one fascinating little vignette, one of the reasons I'm so jet-lagged is I came from San Francisco, which is really a long time zone, a few time zones away yesterday. Now, San Francisco Airport is one of the most globalized places. San Francisco local authority insists that 40% of the content in those shops at San Francisco Airport is local, from the San Francisco Bay Area. That's just a decision that they've taken as part of the contract on the airport. You can do that sort of thing. They're benefiting from globalization. It's an airport. But they are setting some rules around how they want to promote their local development through that. So, you know,
Is that WTO legal?
I think you could do things. It's not a trade issue. It's domestic, right? Clearly the issues around it. And interesting enough, the people that work in those stores are all foreign. The question on oil and gas content, do you want to just play that out a bit more in terms of the local dimension?
I'm just interested in the point of view of encouraging investment in different countries. There's where there's operating companies going into countries, but they're required to have a certain level of local content as part of their contracts, and there's a difference of culture, if you like, between what they're used to doing and what they're being asked to do. And just interested in your perspective on that development.
Well, I don't know much about the oil and gas area, but I do know about local content in, say, motor manufacturing. I had the rather perverse history that I went into exile from South Africa and supported sanctions very strongly on South Africa. And the South African government insists on local content. And one of the things that the ANC did when it came to power was to open up that local content to a much greater extent, although there are still very strong local content requirements. I think the important thing about local content is understanding the sustainability and the relationship to the rest of the economy. So if you are producing the minerals and the metals and you have the skills necessary to support that, and it will keep that plant competitive, not only in terms of exports, but for your domestic consumers. Because I think what's often lost in the trade debate is that your domestic consumers are the ones that end up paying much higher and getting a worse product often if you really stop traded goods coming in. I think it's a very important way of allowing that development. But it has to be done, I think, with time phasing, with all sorts of very careful boundaries, because insisting simply on local content, of course, is a recipe for autarky. And that's really very, very negative, I believe.
Jeff Powell from the Bretton Woods Project has just put some pamphlets about the Bretton Woods Project over here if you want to pick one up. I think there's time for just one other quick question and then we'll wind up. Yes. Yes.
Hi,
this will be the last question. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Mohammed and I'm a student of marketing and finance at the postgraduate level. My question again is regarding the transparency, which was briefly touched upon by you
Can
in the lecture.
Can you just slow down a bit?
So regarding transparency, which was briefly touched upon by you in your lecture and also one of the colleagues there, I recently read in the media that as Mr. Wolfowitz has rejected a few loans to the African nations based on their history of graft and corruption, and many of the African nations are in dire need of trade or aid. So is there a credit rating system in place at the World Bank which takes care of graft? And secondly, there's been suggestions in the media that America has been offering free trade agreements to its partners in war on terrorism and running it as a foreign policy tool. So do you think there's a threat that as Mr. Wolfowitz is heading the organization, the World Bank, that this opportunity like offering loans to these nations, it can be run as a foreign policy tool as well?
Yeah, I think the first part of the question was... the first part of the question, I think, is about whether the lending, if I understand right, the lending to African other countries being stopped from corruption is political or is related, and whether we have a credit rating or other sort of objective criteria for it. The second part is whether it relates to U.S. foreign policy, because Mr. Wolfowitz comes out of the administration, if I'm right on that. I think on the credit rating issue, yes, we do have a credit rating is sort of the wrong expression, but we have an internal system called the CPIA, Country Performance Indicator Assessment. Is that right, Jeff? You probably you know the acronym better than I do, and it's partly on the web. It's a combination of lots of different metrics, very different to a sort of a Standard & Poor's Moody's credit rating, which only looks at really at the macro. It includes institutional, it includes governance, and so on. And there's a very rich internal debate about its accuracy, how it compares to other benchmarks, whether it should include other dimensions like human rights, and so on. But there is a system, but that is not the system that's... That drives the overall allocation of IDA money to a significant extent. But it's not the CPIA triggers that have led to the cutting off of loans to a number of countries. That is particular allegations or concerns regarding corruption in particular projects, which is a slightly, much more conjunctural, if you want, issue. And so I think they are not directly related. The CPIA also tends to be an indicator, like many indicators, which depends on past data, like year or two or three-year-old data. And so there's often not an immediacy to the numbers. Will Mr. Wolfowitz bring the U.S. administration into the bank? That's a very difficult question for me to comment on. Clearly, part of the global governance arrangement in which the president of the World Bank is the World Bank is owned by 184 countries. But there is a deal between basically the Europeans and the U.S. that the Europeans will have the IMF head and the U.S. will have the World Bank head. Do I think that's a good deal? Unofficially, obviously, competitive processes, which we all believe in, where the best person from any country gets the job, irrespective of nationality, is the standards one should apply, I think, to leadership as well. Is that realpolitik? That's a separate question. But basically, the Europeans have to give up the IMF if they want trade on this. And that's a very high-level, G8 leadership question, which... is well above my pay grade to engage in. But clearly that's the given that we're in, and it's clearly part of the global governance story, and it's locked into the distant past and hasn't evolved with the times. Now, does that mean that the president of the World Bank brings the U.S. administration into the bank? I think in part, clearly, it's an American perspective running the bank. That's clear. I would really stress the fact that the U.S. is only one of the 22 board members, that the checks and balances in the system are reasonably strong, particularly on day-to-day operational and policy broad issues. So it is a very, very public and contested institution, and I think that's very healthy, partly to the work of groups like the Bretton Woods Project and others that are there looking at us and know us better than some of us know the institution ourselves. That's a good thing. So I think it's very difficult. And if you look at the evolution of the bank's policies over the last 60 years, it's very difficult to say there are cases, and books have been written about this, that the bank did this because it was U.S. foreign policy. But there may be 10 cases of that over a 60-year period. It's a very isolated thing. Now, whether it did something because of G8 policy or consensus amongst the G8 that the bank should do something is a broader question. Yes, because the G8 has the money, it's the donor contribution and so on. So that's the whole thing. And if you go and speak to the Netherlands government, for example, which is not part of the G8, they will tell you a lot about what they think on certain decisions that were taken at the G8 that they weren't part of. It's not just a developing country rich thing. It's a broader thing. But in the end, the bank decision-making process does come down to a much broader group. So I think the ability, particularly nowadays, for the bank to be used very instrumentally in that way is extremely limited. I don't want to say it's impossible. I said it's extremely limited.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you very much. That was an interesting account. And we'll be back next year. You'll be back next year to talk about migration.
I'll be up outside for 15 minutes. Happy to chat to any of you individually and.